Hello, this is Carlos Pascual, Senior Vice President for Global Energy and International Affairs at IHS Markit. Welcome to these CERAWeek conversations with thought leaders in industry, government, and the policy world. These discussions are being held virtually because of the COVID-19 pandemic. We hope that all of you are sheltering safely wherever you can. We appreciate your spending the time with us. Today, we're going to focus on the question of what will world politics look like after the pandemic? But first, let's take a second to set the context. The COVID-19 pandemic has affected every aspect of our lives. In our economies, it's forced massive contraction. IHS Markit economists are predicting a contraction of 2.8% globally. We've seen as well an oil price war that has driven oil prices to levels that might be as low as $16 to $20 a barrel for the physical barrels that are being purchased today. And in that context, the question that we have to ask is, what will the world of geopolitics look like after the pandemic? In order to facilitate that discussion, we have a tremendous individual and a great friend, Bill Burns. Bill is the president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's been the Deputy Secretary of State. He is the author of a book, The Back Channel, a memoir of American diplomacy and the case for its renewal. Bill, it's a pleasure to have you with us today.
It's great to be with you, Carlos.
Bill, let's start with the issue of the nature of the international political system. We're going through this pandemic on COVID-19. It's clearly a global problem, and yet there's been a hesitance to address it with global solutions. For the future, are we going to see a world that is more isolationist or one that recognizes the interconnectedness that brings us together, whether we like it or not?
Well, I think first, again, it's great to be with you, Carlos. There's a real risk, I think, that we'll move into a much more fragmented international system. The pandemic virus is breaking over all of us at a time of profound transformation in international order. This is a kind of plastic moment of the sort that comes along maybe two or three times a century in international order. The passing of an old order where the United States was the singular dominant player and a transition to a new order whose contours are really not clear to any of us. A moment of major shifts in balance of power with the rise of China among states, but also a period of massive economic, political, technological, and environmental transformations that go beyond the power or the capacity of any one state. I mean, these are the kind of challenges and problems that don't come with passports. And so the question, I think, is whether or not the pandemic is simply going to accelerate a lot of those more destructive trend lines, or whether it's going to clarify our choices and highlight, not just for Americans, not just for the Chinese leadership, but for people around the world, the importance of approaching a lot of these challenges with a kind of enlightened self-interest. You know, an ability to understand that the self-interest of each of our countries is going to depend to an extent on our ability to work with one another on some of those global challenges, even as we continue to compete in sometimes a nastily adversarial way in a lot of other areas.
The term you use, enlightened self-interest, is a good one. It's an important one. And for many people, it almost seems like enlightened self-interest has come to mean protecting oneself, avoiding the disruptions that could affect the United States, as we've seen the impacts, for example, on antibiotics, on vaccines, on ventilators. Where do you think this is likely to take us?
Well, I mean, I think there's a natural impulse for any national leadership to look after its own citizens first. And certainly that's going to be the first response, the first instinct of any political leadership in dealing with this pandemic. But I think we also have to recognize that that pandemic challenge, that crisis, isn't going to respect national borders. And it's in all of our enlightened self-interest to look for ways in which we can coordinate, to learn the lessons that other countries like China or Italy have already experienced in dealing with this awful problem, to pool our resources with regard to development of vaccines, development of antiviral medications, to look at ways in which we can help one another in providing, personal protective equipment and ventilators. and not least to look ahead a little bit at where the next waves of this pandemic crisis are likely to break, because sadly, they've yet to break over large parts of the developing world. You know, societies which are even more vulnerable than the developed world is to what's about to crash over them.
Indeed, having that kind of international cooperation means it has implications for institutions that are able to bring countries together, to have that dialogue, to take those kinds of implications. And yet, what we've seen is that many of those institutions have already become, let's say, a term I've heard you use, the walking wounded. Do we have the capability to, in fact, actually utilize institutions in the way that, in a way that allow us to take those enlightened interests that you're suggesting that we need to take?
I think it's going to be really hard, because I think the erosion of trust in institutions, the slowness with which people have approached the need to reform those institutions, whether it's national ones in the United States or international financial institutions of the UN or any place else, have created real problems. And the drift, I think, in institutions and in people's trust in institutions has been building for some time. It's not just a phenomenon of the Trump era in the United States. But the first step toward dealing with those problems is to recognize, I think, again, the significance of our enlightened self-interest and trying to, you know, make better use of those institutions, to encourage U.S. and Chinese leaderships, for example, to rediscover the habit of cooperation that we did enjoy during the SARS epidemic, during the financial crisis in 2008, during the Ebola, health crisis in 2014. That's a real test of leadership as much as anything else.
The U.S.-China relationship, it seems that right now we have a difficult time on agreeing on anything. Hundreds of thousands of cases throughout the world, potential for hundreds of thousands of deaths. And yet, at the same time, we've gotten into battles over rhetoric of what the virus is actually called. Can the United States and China, as the two central global leaders, can they agree on anything right now?
I hope that we can, and certainly a lot depends upon it right now, because absent some better U.S.-China coordination, it's hard to see how the international community makes much progress in coping not just with the coronavirus pandemic, but with lots of other global challenges, from climate change to how do you, manage the benefits, develop rules of the road to take full advantage of the benefits of the revolution in technology, but minimize the dislocations. I think, U.S.-China relations right now are probably in their worst state in three decades since Tiananmen in 1989. And that comes at the worst possible moment amidst this pandemic virus. I think you see a kind of lazy fatalism in both capitals, in Washington and Beijing. The same kind of lazy fatalism that probably caused us to assume too much the last three decades or so about the benefits of engagement with one another is now causing us, in my view at least, to assume too much about the workability in American policy terms of containing China's rise or of decoupling our economies. And in China, in Beijing, and the Chinese leadership, you see the same tendency to assume the worst about American intentions right now. So cutting through that is going to be the biggest test of, statecraft, I think, for the United States that we've faced in a very long time, certainly since the end of the Cold War.
You wrote recently, Bill, in the Wall Street Journal that the world's military and economic center of gravity is shifting from west to east. Is the United States ready for that?
Oh, I think, I'm not sure that we're ready at this point. I think certainly in the last administration, what the Obama White House tried to do was anticipate that, but, got sucked back into a lot of the problems of other parts of the world, like the Middle East. And so, this is a challenge that's going to be with us in terms of American strategy for quite some time. And it's going to involve, the whole range of tools of American national security policy, diplomacy, in other words, showing up, taking advantage of our real assets, America's real assets across Asia, countries from India to traditional treaty allies like Japan and South Korea that don't want to be forced to make a choice between China and the United States strategically, aren't very, contain their enthusiasm for the notion of containing China's rise, but do share an interest in trying to ensure that China's rise doesn't come at the expense of their prosperity and their security. So that creates an opportunity for wise American leadership aimed not so much at containing China's rise as at shaping the environment into which China rises. So you have to make full use of diplomacy. Certainly military coordination is a part of that strategy, but so is our capacity to try to help shape rules of the road across Asia. That's where the Trans-Pacific Partnership, negotiated at the end of the Obama administration, I think would have helped to shape the incentives and disincentives of the Chinese leadership. I'm not trying to argue it was a perfect trade agreement, but perfect is rarely on the menu in diplomacy or trade negotiations or anything else. I think we're generally better off when the United States is the first mover in trying to shape a lot of those rules.
Bill, let's move to another part of the world, Saudi Arabia, Russia, and oil markets. We saw today that President Trump tweeted that Saudi Arabia is committed to cut back its oil production. Let's put aside for a second whether or not that's actually going to occur and take us behind the scenes to the personalities. What's it going to take for Saudi Arabia and Russia to have a significant discussion that can lead the world in the kinds of oil production cuts that are necessary to rebalance markets?
Well, I think Russia and Saudi Arabia, just as you suggested, and their leaders have created a pretty combustible stew right now of stubbornness and hubris and cold calculation. And I think in those three categories, Vladimir Putin and Mohammed bin Salman are pretty well matched. I think the huge collapse in global demand has accelerated the price competition and the dilemmas for both Russia and Saudi Arabia, along with the rest of the global energy market, in ways that neither of those two leaders really anticipated. So it's a good thing that the United States is engaged directly in trying to stabilize the situation. You know, that the coronavirus pandemic has yet to really break over either Russia or Saudi Arabia. So those leaders have to look ahead to that as well. So this is a moment, I think, where, you know, artful American diplomacy of the sort that President Trump is, you know, suggesting that he's embarked upon can play a really useful role.
Is the United States able to maintain a credible position in the Middle East, given the announcement of its withdrawal in effect from Syria? It's the uncertainty that some countries have seen around its actions related to Iran after the downing of drones and missile strikes on Saudi Arabia. How is the United States positioned now to maintain credibility with its Middle East allies?
Well, we're not especially well positioned right now. I think we've been torn over recent decades between the tendency to overreach, the temptation to exaggerate America's transformative powers in the Middle East. That was certainly what in large part, I think, shaped the disaster that was the war in Iraq in 2003 and what flowed from that. But I think we're torn between that temptation to overreach and then, you know, the notion, which is understandable on the part of a lot of American citizens right now, to detach ourselves altogether from what our really cold-bloodedly continuing interests in the Middle East. And so the challenge, I think, for any American administration is not to overreach, it's not to disengage, it's to shift the terms of our engagement. And I would argue put more emphasis on diplomacy, less reliance on military tools, although the role of the U.S. military is still going to be important, and to try to find ways in which the United States, within the limits of our power, can ease, you know, some of the conflicts that are tearing apart the region, whether it's between Iran and Saudi Arabia, or Palestinians and Israelis, and to help, you know, leaders in the region and societies in the region address some of the dysfunctions that produced the Arab Spring almost a decade ago now, and are going to produce more Arab Springs unless that sense of indignity, those inequalities in lots of societies across the region are addressed. And so, you know, the United States, there are limits to our ability to affect all of those challenges, but we can't detach ourselves entirely from them either.
And what would you expect for the U.S.-Iran relationship?
Well, right now, I mean, it's easy to keep your expectations under control. I think the real risk is of further collisions between the United States and Iran. I think it was a foolish mistake for the United States to abandon the comprehensive nuclear agreement with Iran, not because I would suggest that it's a perfect agreement, but I think it was the best of the available alternatives to prevent the Iranian regime from developing a nuclear weapon. I think right now, in terms of American policy, that our approach, which the Trump White House defines as maximum pressure, is not tethered to realistic goals in dealing with Iran. It's a form of coercive diplomacy that's all coercion and no diplomacy. If the assumption is that that maximum pressure, which has done and can continue to do enormous economic damage to Iran, but if the assumption is that that's going to produce either the capitulation of this Iranian regime or its implosion, much as I'd like to see the Iranian people have a different leadership, I just don't think those are realistic goals right now. So the question is, can you tether, you know, that economic leverage to some realistic goals? One of them could be a better, tighter agreement. It could be working towards some kind of understandings on winding down terrible regional conflicts like the war in Yemen today. But that's going to require, you know, really intensive, persistent diplomacy attached to the leverage that we can bring to bear. And I don't see much evidence of that right now.
So in some ways, the situation with COVID-19, the crippling, the pain that it's caused, can also create some opportunities for discussion and dialogue if there's a willingness to do it and if there is a smart approach to diplomacy that's applied to it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it can. I wouldn't exaggerate the possibilities. Certainly there's a humanitarian urgency to this. I mean, the Iranian people today, I think anyway, are caught between the cynical mismanagement of the pandemic by their own leadership and economic strangulation as a result of sanctions. And I think it is important for the United States, for European partners, to find ways, you know, in which humanitarian relief can be provided to the Iranian people. That may create some modest opportunities to begin a dialogue on everything from the release of unjustly detained Americans in Iran to, as I suggested before, beginning to push for a diplomatic resolution of the war in Yemen. So, you know, there is such a thing as disaster diplomacy and trying to take advantage of even modest, you know, openings that could develop during even the worst of crises.
Let's stay with the humanitarian theme. You mentioned India, Africa beforehand. And indeed, for these countries, all of the recommendations that have been mentioned to contain COVID-19 are virtually impossible. Social distancing isn't an option. There's a lack of clean water, a lack of sanitation, a lack of medical facilities. And the possibility of an impending humanitarian crisis seems almost inevitable. What happens for these parts of the world, for the developing world, and what is their position afterwards?
Well, sadly, I think, Carlos, just as you suggested, it's a pretty grim picture. I think that the pandemic, the wave of the pandemic has yet to break over a lot of parts of the developing world right now. And again, as you suggested, these are parts of the world and societies where physical distancing just doesn't work, where populations are densely packed together, where, you know, economic imperative is, you know, the day-to-day business of earning a living, where people can't afford to physically distance themselves or stay away from work and earning their livelihoods, where governments can't afford to pay people to use that kind of physical distancing, and where for all the huge challenges we face in the United States, for example, today, over health infrastructure and our preparedness, you know, that pales in comparison to the vulnerabilities of a lot of those societies. So it's really important, I think, that the United Nations and, you know, other international institutions are trying to look ahead and, you know, attract resources that can help those societies and those leaderships prepare for what's coming. But I fear that once that wave sweeps over those parts of the world, you know, you're going to have a trail of destruction that's going to be with us and with those societies for many years to come. And we're, you know, I think we're kidding ourselves in the developed world, in the United States or any place else, if we think that we're immune to the repercussions of that. Because not only are we going to have to help deal with the human catastrophe that emerges, but we're also going to have to deal with the problems of regional conflicts that can be intensified as a result of that, with the fertile ground for extremism that gets created as a result, with the movement of people and the migrations, which can be so difficult for other parts of the world to deal with too. So it pays, as difficult as the, you know, as the future looks, to look ahead and see what we can do to help ease at least that blow.
Let's bring the discussion to the United States bill and the topic of enlightened self-interest. You advocate in your book the importance of a renewal of American diplomacy. Is this a moment where that can happen? What are the stakes for the United States?
Well, I think the stakes are pretty high. I mean, you know, if you look at the landscape that we're moving into today, which is a much more competitive, contested, complicated international landscape where the United States is no longer the only big kid on the geopolitical block, where economic and military leverage still matter enormously, but where it's going to pay for the United States to try to mobilize coalitions of countries and invest in our alliances so that we can compete better and, you know, protect our own security and prosperity and advance it better as well. That's where diplomacy ought to be our tool of first resort. And I think we've fallen into bad habits, especially in the two decades since 9/11, of kind of inverting the roles of force and diplomacy. And so this is a moment when, as I tried to argue in the book, where I think it's absolutely essential for American leaderships to look at the value of reinvesting in diplomacy as a matter of our own enlightened self-interest.
Bill, one of the things you've demonstrated in your comments is that the world is indeed interconnected. And the challenge that we face is, how do we rise to that challenge of interconnectedness? How do we manage it in a way that reflects the kind of enlightened self-interest that you've spoken about? One of the things that you've shown is that we affect each other. And as we pursue that enlightened self-interest, we need to think not only of what is directly best for ourselves, but how we affect other countries, how they affect us. And that combination of considerations is what's going to bring us to the best solutions for our country. Thank you for sharing those insights. Thank you for the discussion we've had today.
My pleasure. Great to be with you.